Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, November 5th. We spent a lot of time on the show yesterday and on Wednesday asking what just happened, that the Democrats did as badly as they did in Virginia, New Jersey, Long Island, and elsewhere. We'll begin today with a take from New York Times columnist Jamelle Bouie on how the Democrats might learn from the results to hold the House and Senate in next year's election, but with an eye on Bill Clinton and the 90s, the moral price they might pay to get there. Jamelle also wrote a column about one thing that cannot be taken away, despite the racial moral panic campaign that seems to have carried the day in the Virginia governor's race. And this is not a take from the New York Times building in Times Square, we might say. Jamelle Bouie lives in Charlottesville, is also with the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia there. He's also a CBS News political analyst. Jamelle, we always learn a lot when you come on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's start with what you call the moral panic against critical race theory promoted by Republican candidate Glenn Youngkin, who is now the governor-elect of Virginia. Can you describe why you use that term, moral panic, and why you conclude that Youngkin and his allies have already lost that battle, even though they won the election?
I call it a moral panic because there doesn't seem to be a ton of actual content behind the complaints. And the complaints range, right? Sort of on the most reasonable end, you have complaints about, you know, diversity trainings, corporate diversity trainings, maybe diversity trainings for teachers in administration. And then on the other end, on the end of things that sounds to me, you know, frankly, incredible, and I mean incredible in the literal sense of the word, incredible, are claims like preschool teachers teaching, you know, 2 or 3 year old white children to hate themselves, elementary school teachers teaching, you know, black students that they are victims. I happen to be married to an educator, to a teacher. I happen to spend a lot of time around teachers, and it just doesn't jive with my experience of educators or teachers. And I would bet you that if you could somehow do a survey of classrooms in the state, in the Commonwealth, you would find that these sorts of claims are, if not sort of untethered from reality, then certainly overblown. But what is the case is that there is, you know, real anxiety about the shifting way that people talk about race and racism, about the way that are, at least in some corners of our culture. And there's a parenthetical I want to make here. I think that the extent to which so many commentators who speak about this live in sort of big liberal cities maybe colors their sense of what is like normal and common in large parts of the country. But it's certainly the case, right, that like in rural Virginia, it was really uncommon to talk about race and racism in ways that presumed that there was something wrong with American society. Mm-hmm. And as we saw last year with the George Floyd protests, there were a lot of young people who, because of, I'd say, much more the media they consume and the peer group they have and sort of their exposure to the internet, much more than their teachers and educators, have imbibed some of that thinking and are expressing it, and it scares their parents. This is in Virginia, where we have a history of big controversies over race and education, kind of the paramount one being massive resistance to integration. But to my mind, this looks more like something a little less major than that. It looks like the kind of early 90s panic over the spread of hip hop, of gangster hip hop, gangster rap to white suburbia, right? Sort of this fear of white children, teenagers, preteens, really not just sort of observing black culture and black ideas that come out of black culture and black people, but really kind of internalizing them.
How much finish the thought.
No, that's the thought. I was just going to keep on going. So that's the thought.
Well, my crack team of Jamelle Bouie biographical researchers came up with the fact that you were a school child in Virginia Beach in the 90s and early 2000s. Assuming that's accurate, how do you remember being taught about the history of racism, and how differently do you think it is taught around the state today? How much has it shifted?
So, you know, when I was, that's accurate. I was, we moved to Virginia. My parents were in the military. And so we moved to Virginia in 1994. And I was, you know, in grade school, middle school, high school from, you know, 1994. And I was in first grade to when I graduated from high school in 2005. And, you know, what I remember, a few things. The first is that I remember we celebrated Lee Jackson King Day until, I mean, I think that was a very recent change to Virginia's calendar of holidays. But on Martin Luther King Day, there'd also be sort of pictures and portraits of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson as part of like the people we are celebrating on that day. I do not recall getting a ton of education about the Civil War and Reconstruction and slavery, other than that these are things that happened. Even in high school, much of my history education was either kind of pre, you know, 18th century or 20th century, but the 19th century is sort of a big blank spot as far as education went. My experience of race and racism in school had much less to do with educators and much more to do with my peers. We lived in Virginia Beach, is a predominantly white city. We lived in a part of the city that was predominantly white, but not sort of overwhelmingly so. And my classmates were, you know, largely white, but again, not overwhelmingly so. And I, from a very young age, remember people saying, you know, saying racist things to me from 7 and 8 up until I graduated from high school. And, you know, one thing that's frustrated me about this conversation, kind of pivot from my own biography, which I don't really find that interesting. One thing that has frustrated me about this education is that so much of the questions are when should students begin learning about race and racism? And there's an implicit white there, right? Because students of color, black students, Hispanic students, Asian American students, they learn about race and racism very early on because they experience it. They experience racism very early on, and then their parents have to explain it to them. My parents had to explain why people were being mean to me because of the way I looked. And my strong view here is that if a 7-year-old black child has to experience that, then their white peers should at least have to learn about it. Not in any crazy sophisticated way, but in a way that lets them know that these things are real. And I suspect that what is animating some of the anxiety here is that these kids are then asking their parents about this, and their parents have to answer difficult questions, difficult and uncomfortable questions. I want to sympathize with that, but also at a certain point, I don't.
So now that Youngkin has won with this morally panicked over critical race theory that exists or doesn't exist, white majority, how do you think that might play out on the ground during his administration, different from what we heard as election campaign rhetoric, since presumably they won't stop teaching the history of slavery and Jim Crow or some of the things more newly being brought toward mainstream teaching, like Juneteenth and the Tulsa Massacre and 1619 as an important turning point?
So this is the thing I've been really wrestling with myself, because, you know, Youngkin's campaign rhetoric itself kind of did this thing, and it was a very effective thing, obviously, but it was to say we are not going to not teach the ugly stuff in American history. And on the practical level, in a state like Virginia, you kind of can't. Like I think I said this in one of the pieces you quoted from, but it is it's sort of impossible to teach this state's history in even the most neutral way without a knowledge of you know, race and racism there. So on a practical level, you kind of have to say that thing. But then he would pivot to saying, but we're going to get CRT out of schools. And so it's unclear to me what that exactly even means. And given that the governor's office doesn't actually have a ton of influence over curriculum, I suppose, and given that Virginia Democrats still retain control of the Senate, I don't think the state's going to see any of the kind of laws that have been passed in much more conservative places like Tennessee or Texas. My hunch is that this might empower localities, certainly individual school districts, to adjust their curriculums, to remove material from their curriculums. But I have a sense that there's not going to be any real practical changes from in the actual administration of things. No sort of major significant changes. Because of course, Virginia students, you know, they take AP exams, right? They take IB exams, right? They attend, you know, world class universities in the state, so you can't actually just like erase this stuff from the curriculum.
Right. They have to know stuff.
They have to know stuff. The last point I'll say, and this relates to Trump, I think Trump did, and I think this was like a politically clever thing, was he would run on something, not actually do anything about it, but then tell people he did something about it. And people would be like, okay, that checks out. And I think Youngkin might do something similar. I think 6 months from now, he'll give a speech and say, you know, we've gotten CRT out of schools, and this may mean literally nothing practically, but people will believe it because, you know, he said it.
Yeah, and I would predict they'll find individual lines in teacher diversity trainings and things like that to gin up the moral outrage over again and use those as flashpoints to keep the conversation alive to their political advantage, even while the larger teaching that you described goes on. We'll see if that happens. Jamelle Bouie, New York Times columnist, is my guest. So looking ahead to the 2022 midterms, you wrote a column last month about a central demographic divide being much discussed in Democratic circles right now, that a crucial determinant of who votes Democratic and who votes Republican these days is education. The college-educated vote for the Dems, the non-college-educated not, especially among white and Latino men, and that this intersects with racial resentment as a driving political force. Can you describe that demographic challenge and that intersection as you see it in the context of 2022?
Yes, I think in Virginia, there is the education gap widened, right? Youngkin made huge ground with white women without a college degree, which is a group that I believe Biden only lost narrowly, and Youngkin won overwhelmingly. And I think in New Jersey as well, you saw these education based shifts, not non-college educated voters shifting further to Republicans. And I expect this to continue next year. It's an interesting question why this is the case. You know, one theory, right, one popular theory is that, you know, Democrats are too, quote unquote, woke, which is something that, again, seems like something you say if you aren't really familiar with how politics operates in most of the rest of the country. I don't really see any evidence of that beyond, you know, maybe urban centers on the coast. And it's possible, right, that the nationalization of politics means that even that has just a big impact on how ordinary voters understand these things. But my sense of it is that, you know, as the Democratic Party has taken on more and more college-educated people, separate and apart from any sort of new language about race or gender or anything, I think there is just a sense that the Democratic Party might become its image might be of that of, you know, very educated people. And I do think there's something to that. I think if you look at candidate selection, right, if you look at the candidates that are put out, you know, when Democrats look for veterans, right, they don't tend to look for former enlisted people. They tend to gravitate towards officers who are highly educated. You know, the Democratic Party isn't really fielding, right, nurses, isn't really fielding, you know, former construction workers, isn't really fielding non-college educated candidates. Whereas the Republican Party is at least fielding business people. And I think this is something that's just generally underrated, which is that many Americans, most Americans, maybe even they admire business people. They want to be prosperous. They want to have that kind of independence. They admire that kind of independence. And I wonder if part of what the Republican Party has happened onto with Trump in particular, with Trump being a very prominent business person who didn't necessarily run on tax cuts, what they've happened onto is sort of they've plugged into the what you might call the producerism that really has a lot of force in American politics, this idea that you want to aspire to being a producer of things, an owner of things, an entrepreneur. But I think that really appeals to people in a lot of communities and people that that appeals to I'll speak from experience here. My best friend growing up, his dad was a construction worker and his mother was a hairdresser and his sister, had kids a little early and was in community college and was getting her degree in order to open her own business. And many of his aunts and uncles and such did own their own businesses. And this was a mixed family of immigrants and non-immigrants. And aspiring to owning one's business was an important thing. And I think the Republican Party has maybe plugged into that in a potent way, in a way that the Democratic Party hasn't.
Interesting. That column of yours from last month is called Bill Clinton, Race and the Politics of the 1990s. And you set up the idea that he faced some similar political questions trying to win the presidency for the Democrats after 12 years of Reagan and H.W. Bush. So maybe it's no surprise that after this week's election, Clinton's main political advisor from those days, James Carville, said this on PBS about the way back to victory next year.
Yes.
Some people need to go to a woke detox center or something. I mean, they're expressing the language that people just don't use. And there's a backlash and a frustration at that. Don't just look at Virginia and New Jersey. Look at Long Island. Look at Buffalo. Look at Minneapolis. Even look at Seattle, Washington. I mean, this defund the police lunacy, to take Abraham Lincoln's name off of schools. I mean, that people see that.
Jamel, your reaction to that? And at the beginning of the clip, I think I was talking over it. He said woke detox Democrats need to go for.
Right. I mean, it's this thing where if you are hyper plugged into every single little controversy that happens, this might sound persuasive, but thinking practically, who are the Democratic candidates who are speaking in this manner? Not Terry McAuliffe, right? Not Phil Murphy, right? Like, who are the actual Democratic candidates who are speaking in this matter? Who are the actual Democratic candidates, politicians, anyone who is calling to defund the police? There's this thing that's happening, this slipperiness from, I think, analysts who are just hostile to progressives to begin with, in which the actions of college students are conflated with elected officials, in which, you know, hyper-local controversies over a statue become, synecdoches for, you know, an entire political movement. And when national commentators take this stuff and hype it up, of course, they're going to create the impression that it's a pervasive thing when it very clearly is not, right? I would say that, you know, insofar that anyone needs to get some perspective, it might be people like Carville, and maybe instead of, you know, proclaiming that there needs to be a quote unquote woke detox, maybe there needs to be a detox of the kind of, corporate, not even moderate, but sort of like bland candidates that the Democratic Party is fielding, right? Glenn Youngkin, for whatever, I mean, he excited people, and Terry McAuliffe did not. And if you begin to look down the line, you're looking at candidates who didn't really excite people. A counterpoint to this is the Georgia special, right? Where the top vote getter in the runoff was Raphael Warnock, who I guess by some accounts might be woke, a black preacher from a black church. By other accounts, I think it's the kind of candidate Democrats should be looking for. Someone who has, even if he's well-educated, does not have sort of a college-educated affect. Someone who can clearly speak to people, who can speak naturally and speak clearly to non-college educated people, who can communicate values strongly and you can excite people. I think if you can find more candidates like that, you'd have better luck. But looking at the loss of Terry McAuliffe and the concluding that the problem is too much wokeness just seems ludicrous to me.
From Charlottesville, Virginia, New York Times columnist Jamel Bowie, whose Twitter bio includes the line, "I don't live in New York." Jamel, always so interesting and insightful. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.